If you asked me, Pat, if you said, Michael, what's the number one thing that someone should know? Is that just like you just said, 90% of your risk for that first heart attack can be mitigated by lifestyle modifications.
Right.
So this idea of like, I have bad genes.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty rare, actually. Yes, people have genetic predisposition to things. But the majority of that risk is because patients have had poor lifestyles. They smoke. They don't sleep right. They don't exercise. Their diets are heavy, very heavy in animal fat.
Yeah.
And if they can just make some changes, then they can reduce that risk. Times are related is your currency.
Oh, you can spend it how you like. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Eat Green, Make Green podcast. This is Pat McCauley, as always. I'm super excited to share my guest this week. It is the one and only Dr. Michael Farmer. Dr. Farmer is a Boston-based preventative cardiologist. He's also the founder of the virtual preventative cardiology platform, Corverix, which is currently in startup mode. He is also a clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School. He's a fellow of the American College of Cardiology, and he currently practices at Mass General here in Boston, which is widely regarded as one of the best hospitals in the country. So when it comes to cardiology, when it comes to preventing heart disease and heart attacks, obviously Dr. Farmer knows his stuff. So I was honored to have him on to talk all things prevention. We talk about how his frustration over the years with reactively treating patients led him toward preventative cardiology. The current landscape of heart disease in the U.S., how we can use wearables to help prevent heart disease, and all about what he's doing with Corverix around wearables. The importance of knowing your own numbers, even as a young person, your numbers, your cholesterol, your blood pressure, etc. The four areas he recommends to focus on to reduce your risk of heart disease, how he personally copes with the life and death stakes of cardiology, the importance of educating both physicians and patients on the power of lifestyle changes, and why we need radical change away from our illness-based medical model to a preventative value-based model. There is so much good info in this episode. Again, Dr. Farmer obviously knows his stuff. Heart disease, as you may or may not know, is the number one cause of death in the world. One in four people, it may be higher than that now, will die of heart disease. It is preventable. So much good information. I'll let Michael tell the rest here, but follow what he's doing at Corverix. Get your notebooks out and take notes on this one and share this one with loved ones. Without further ado, the one and only Dr. Michael Farmer. Times are related is your currency. Oh, you can spend it. All right, I got Dr. Michael Farmer in the house. Actually, I'm in your house, I should say.
That's right.
But we're in Boston, and it feels nice. We've been starting to do some more in person, and it just feels semi-normal again, which is really nice.
I bet. It's been the same with patients at the hospital.
People starting to come back in.
Starting to come back.
Yeah.
So it's been a year of a lot of virtual visits, which is great. I love telehealth, but I actually like seeing the patients.
Yeah.
And there's something to that. And I think there'll always be a place for that. So I agree in all aspects.
Yeah.
Nice to get back in person.
Yeah, absolutely. So for people that aren't familiar with you, I'd love to just kind of give you the floor to kind of give a little bit of your background. For people that don't know, you're a Boston-based cardiologist, more recently in preventative cardiology, we can define that later on, but give us kind of the path.
Wow.
Now,
the floor is open. All right.
Yeah.
Let's not go all the way back. How about just starting to think a little bit about cardiovascular disease. So I started my internship, I guess about 20 years ago or so. And, you know, you're exposed to all sorts of things, right? You're just like an intern and trying to figure out what you wanted to do. And when I started here in Boston, I really didn't know. I was interested in, you don't know, coming out of medical school. It's you've sort of been your internship. And I think right away after, you know, a couple of weeks, actually can remember back in training, it was cardiology from the beginning for me. Yeah. You know, some of the other stuff, oncology, interesting, yeah. A lot of science, but when you're in your 20s and a young person in the hospital, you know, cardiology is where it's at. It, you know, it's where the action is. Very life and death. When you're on one of those rotations as a trainee, it's, you know, just going to the emergency department, patients having a massive heart attack, and you know, that artery's blocked, and you can actually do something. So I liked the procedural aspect of it. I liked that it was just a lot of stuff encompassed in that cardiovascular disease, from some of the prevention, which I ignored for about 15 years,
yeah.
To the treatment end. And I think initially what drew me towards it was the procedures. I liked the procedures. Mm. And I found a lot of great mentors who I work with, and I went on to do a cardiovascular disease fellowship. And then for what I do, which is cardiac electrophysiology, which is a subspecialty, it's an interventional subspecialty, which is focused on cardiac arrhythmias, like sudden cardiac death, like atrial fibrillation, which a lot of athletes have.
Mm-hmm.
And what you learn in your fellowship is how to treat those diseases. And a lot of that treatment is procedures like pacemaker implantation,
mm-hmm.
defibrillator implantation, and then these things called ablation procedures, where you put catheters up in people's hearts and you find those electrical circuits where you can apply heat, thermal energy usually, to sort of disrupt those circuits. So really electricians of the heart. And I think there was a lot of satisfaction in the beginning of my career, you know, doing those procedures. You'd bring them in, that the heart rate was 20 beats per minute and patients in heart block, you put these wires in the heart and it's fixed.
Mm.
And I really enjoyed that. And if you had asked me about preventive cardiology, you know, 20 years ago, I would have been like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And I spent the better half of, you know, after I finished all that training, the 14 years really focused on illness-based care. So, you know, referring physicians sent me patients that had arrhythmia issues that maybe they thought needed an ablation or needed a defibrillator implanted. And 9 times out of 10, they did. And most of the time, that's what I would do. I did procedures and I enjoyed that for quite some period of time. But I began over the last, 5-6 years or so, I became frustrated with that model, that sort of reactive illness-based model. It's not the same in every hospital or every locale, but where I was, it sort of felt like, you know, just waiting in the emergency department. So you had your heart attack, you had your stroke, and then we had all these amazing procedures, really state-of-the-art things that we could do to treat patients that had arrhythmias, that treat patients that needed a device implantation. And I began having conversations with patients that would be referred to me for a heart ablation, let's say, someone my age in their 40s. And yes, they had these arrhythmia, maybe let's say atrial fibrillation was a very common arrhythmia. But, you know, I'd start talking to them, you know, horrible diet, overweight, too obese, high blood pressure, not treated adequately, not exercising. And I began working with patients, sometimes using wearables, sometimes not, just to say, hey, you may need this procedure, but you know, the bigger picture, the reason why you have this arrhythmia, atrial fibrillation, is you have high blood pressure and you're obese, you're not sleeping right, maybe you have obstructive sleep apnea, and really working with them to try to prevent cardiovascular disease. And I'm not formally trained in preventive cardiology. There's right. fellowships for that, which includes both trying to prevent strokes and heart attacks before they're happening. And it also means in patients that have a diagnosis of cardiovascular disease, like say they've had a heart attack, trying to prevent that second heart attack. And I think that's a lot of where those drugs come in, those statin drugs and those other drugs. So a lot of the focus of preventive cardiologists are medications. But the aspect that I'm most interested in is actually preventing any event. So it really wasn't until the latter half of the last two decades that I became more focused in preventing heart disease rather than just reacting to it.
Yeah. It's the idea of like treating and managing a disease versus healing someone from that disease, right?
That's right.
I follow kind of one of the initial people who kind of changed my thinking around diet was Dean Ornish. And he has that analogy he uses of the sink filling up with water. It's like a bathroom sink filling up with water and it's overflowing onto the floor. And, we just to kind of continuously mop up the sink.
Yep.
And make sure like the floor you can at least walk on.
Yep.
But it makes more sense to just turn off the faucet, right?
I love that analogy. And it's gonna be difficult for our healthcare system to fix this. But I think we're moving towards that, getting away from this. I mean, you're like, how did we get to this place? And we have a fee for service model, right? We're incentivized to do procedures. There's no incentives there to prevent heart attacks and provide value-based care. I mean, fortunately, there's a lot of physicians and policymakers working on initiatives now to change that. And we are moving to more of a value-based model. We're certainly not there yet in cardiovascular disease.
Meaning like right now, like you don't, like you get paid when you do procedures.
That's right.
You don't get paid when you tell somebody to go home and start working out and eating, right?
That's right.
You know, you, like a healthy patient is a non-paying customer the average doctor,
that's right?
That's right. Yeah. Super interesting, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, so you start to make this shift in kind of like just awareness of like, you're putting the pieces together that prevention is kind of a lot more effective than, giving somebody like a short-term solution that likely they're probably going to come back again. You're not really, as we said, we're not turning off the faucet. So when did you kind of like decide you wanted to go the preventative route and like maybe how that led to Corvarix
as
well.
Yep. So in parallel, at the same time, I had a lot of frustration with that reactive model where there seemed to be like just concerns on how many EKGs we're ordering, how many tests we're ordering, how many procedures we're doing. I certainly had some frustration with that, but I also became increasingly interested in wearables. When I say wearables, I guess I should take a step back and sort of define that. Yeah. So that's like the smartwatches, like we were talking about, like Apple Watch, Fitbit, Oura Rings, Whoop Bands. But it's also electronic blood pressure cuffs, electronic scales. So anything that can obtain a digital biomarker and, put it on a platform that then a user can use and a doctor can use. In parallel to all these frustrations, I was really becoming focused on patients coming in, this is a couple of years ago, everyone's walking in the door with an Apple Watch, or Fitbit. What are you doing with your Fitbit? How is that affecting the changes that you need to make? Because we're doing is cardiologists or medical professionals as a group, Pat, we are doing a terrible job. I don't know why more people don't talk about it. I mean, I think we do, but if you really think about it, one in three of us has pre-diabetes, but that's not to mention the other 30 million or so that have diabetes. Half of us have high blood pressure. That's crazy. Half of us have high cholesterol. These are the worst. 70% to 80% now, depending on the study, overweight or obese. That is like, I mean, it blows bananas. My mind. Yeah. And those numbers get worse and worse. Not to mention the exercise component, right? The AHA recommends 150 minutes of exercise. You get that. You probably got that this weekend. But 80% of Americans don't even achieve sort of minimal exercise. And I mean, one of the most striking things for me was seeing that when the CDC's last data comes out, there's a little bit of a lag. I think this was a 2019 data. But the death rate for cardiovascular disease for the middle age, which I'm in the middle age now, 45 to 64, is increasing. Everything else is decreasing. We're doing a good job. You know, the folks at Farber are crushing it. We're doing a great job. Yeah. We're doing a great job in old people. Let me tell you, if you're a 110, there isn't a hospital around town that's not going to jam some valve into your aorta to fix something. We're doing great with old people, but really where the focus needs to be, in my opinion, and younger people, it's just not there. And I was finding the wearables were very helpful in doing this in terms of helping motivate for exercise, right? Looking at metrics that I felt were kind of overwhelming people. And you have these Apple Watches, the technology is giving people fairly accurate heart rate variability, right?
Yeah.
Most people have no idea what... I have patients come in, think it's great that theirs is low, right?
Yeah, I don't know what that means either.
Yeah. So a high one's good.
Yep.
And a low one's not as good, and it's a predictive of cardiovascular mortality. Mm-hmm. So your heart rate variability is, which I think everyone should know. You can probably get it off your Garmin. But it is that beat-to-beat variability in your heartbeat. And you would think that wouldn't be a good thing.
Yeah.
But it's actually a good thing. It's a positive thing for your heart to have, this is measured in milliseconds, right? A significant beat-to-beat variation. So professional athletes, very high HRVs. People that are very deconditioned, don't exercise, overweight, very low HRVs because they have a little bit of elevated heart rates. And it's like a Swiss watch. You know, it's like boom, 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 right. Boom, boom. And you can do things with your lifestyle to improve that, right? Like, say, sleep a little better. Get your 8 hours of sleep. Moderate on the alcohol.
Yeah.
Hydrate. Get those exercise minutes. So HRV is just an example of one of the dozens of biomarkers that we can use from different wearables to help prevent cardiovascular disease. And that's what I became interested in.
All right.
And what I wanted to do when I left my full-time practice, I still see patients one day a week right down the street here. But what I wanted to do was to build a mobile application that could fill that gap, that could connect users, wearable-enabled users, and virtual preventive cardiologists to help the user and other stakeholders prolong life, you know, prevent that heart attack and stroke. And so that's what I've been working on over the last several months. And it's been an exciting journey. You know, I hopped off right pre-pandemic, and there's been a lot of evolution and a lot of bumps in the road, but it's amazing how much progress you made, and it's really been an exciting time for me.
That's awesome. Yeah, and to touch on kind of like the importance of getting people on board at a younger age, I saw you posted something recently about, and something I was kind of like shocked to learn, you know, years ago as I was learning more and more, of the fact that, you know, these diseases that kill us later in life, and heart disease obviously being the number one killer in the world, like you don't just wake up one day with heart disease. You don't just wake up and have a stroke or a heart attack. it's something that starts from, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And, you know, we know this, at least from the studies I've read, of like when a, you know, child unfortunately dies in a car accident or something, and you look at the autopsy and they already have signs of, they already have atherosclerosis. Yeah.
You took the words out of his mouth. We know from multiple autopsy studies that atherosclerosis begins in the teenage years. And it's really, I mean, part of the solution, the Corvaric solution, is to focus on prevention. Mm. If you already have high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, we can work on that. But I mean, even at a later age, at my age, your age, right, like you missed the boat. That's with years of disease.
Right.
And so I think that we really need to focus on that, what I feel sort of that ignored population, younger people.
Totally. Yeah. It's like, just thinking to, again, kind of like to my journey, like my big, like kind of gripe was just like, I just couldn't believe, you know, here we have this disease that, you know, literally is the number one killer in the world. Right.
Yep.
And we know diet and lifestyle, you know, you can probably argue and you would probably know better than me, but you know, my kind of number is like 95% of heart disease is preventable.
That's right.
And
that's
in many cases, reversible. Right.
So that's, if you asked me, Pat, if you said, Michael, what's the number one thing that someone should know? Is that, just like you just said, 90% of your risk for that first heart attack can be mitigated by lifestyle modifications.
Right.
So this idea of like, oh, I have bad genes.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare, actually. Yes, people have genetic predisposition to things. But the majority of that risk is because patients have had poor lifestyles. They smoke. They don't sleep right. They don't exercise. Their diets are heavy, very heavy in animal fat.
Yeah.
And if they can just make some changes, then they can reduce that risk.
Yeah. Yeah, can we get into kind of some of those recommendations you might give, that just maybe some basic ones for somebody listening that you touched on, sleep, exercise, et cetera.
Sure. I would say the first thing that I would do is, which I find amazing, that a lot of people in their 20s, 30s, they don't really know what their cholesterol is. They don't know if they're a pre-diabetic. Mm. So I think the first thing to do for anyone, adult, would be to, sort of as the AHA says, know your numbers, right? So that would include getting blood work and knowing what a simple lipid panel showed, what your total cholesterol is, what your LDL is, what your hemoglobin A1C is, which is a screening test for diabetes. And then maybe even more importantly, know what your blood pressure is.
Mm.
I can't tell you. I mean, it is amazing. We were fortunate enough. We got things moving very quickly with the app, and we got a prototype out. We did a 6-month beta test. We put a pretty good group of users on this beta test where we got blood work, just like you said, and 6 months on the app, and these were all a lot of my friends, right? And they were all, some of them were college athletes. I mean, these were like fit people. They like to exercise, so they wanted to do this. All got labs on them. Some of them, this is the first time, aside from maybe that rare visit to the doctor's office, they were kind of like checking their blood pressure more regularly. We found 50% of these users had one of these risk factors we were discussing.
Right, and they're relatively healthy people.
Very healthy people.
Yeah, right.
One was a pre-diabetic.
Yeah.
He was like he was flabbergasted.
Yeah.
This guy played tennis at a Division I college. Yeah. He was like still very fit.
Right.
He just couldn't believe it. Multiple users with hypertension. I'd say that's the most common, including myself.
Yeah.
So that's just a very common thing. People should be checking their blood pressure at home. You know, your big takeaway from this is like know your blood pressure.
Mm.
And I think that was just thinking about, you know, blood pressure. and how wearables can help, that, I mean, I've heard time and time again over 20 years, patients come in the hospital, they've had a heart attack or stroke, you're the cardiovascular consultant, you go in, you're talking to them, they're sort of like in shock, well, how did this happen? Do you have high blood pressure? No. When you really, you know, dive into that and you say, do. Well, have you ever been to the doctor? They're like, well, one time I was at my physician and it was high. Oh, it's only high, you know, when I'm at the doctor's office. When else are you checking it? They're not. It's high. So, I mean, I think this idea of white coat hypertension has really been a disservice. So I think, you know your numbers, get your blood work, know what your blood pressure is, get an electronic blood pressure cuff. If you're, you know, check your blood pressure every once in a while. I mean, 50% of the people have high blood pressure. It might be a nice thing to have a cuff in the house, like a quality cuff, so you can check all your family members. I recommend people that struggle with obesity and being overweight, get an electronic scale. Sometimes it's just knowing where your numbers are, know what your BMI is. You can hate using that or like using that. It has its issues. We don't have a better marker of obesity, but, you know, just to know, don't be afraid of that. Sort of embrace that, you know, oh, okay, my BMI is in the obese range and maybe I should work to drop it a little bit. So I think I would start there.
Yeah, I like that.
Just know where you're at, regardless of your age. And then I would think...
Can I ask one thing on that?
Sure, of course.
Is that something like the average person should dig in more than... Like my experience going to like, you know, my primary doctor when I was younger was like, you know, you look healthy, you know? Like I'm kind of in the range of healthy on all these numbers. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, you know, yep, keep eating well and exercising. Like there wasn't like to the level you just talked about with those numbers. So is it kind of on the individual to get that stuff for the most part?
It is. It's education.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great point. You know, primary care physicians are overwhelmed. I mean, that's a hard job.
Yeah.
And they do. They get, if you have a good primary care physician, especially in Boston, over at MGH where I practice now, they do a fantastic job and they're going to make sure that you get your, you know, if you're of a certain age, that you're going to get that lipid panel. But what often I feel is missing there and everywhere is if you don't quite reach criteria for, say, a Lipitor type drug, a statin type drug, then it's like, oh, you don't reach criteria, but it's not, oh, but your cholesterol's, you know, 220. Do you know that's on the high end. And, you know, here's X, Y, and Z that you could do. So what I find is that, what I recommend is that, and users can do this with the app, to really understand what their values are, where their values are on the spectrum, set goals to reduce them, not just, you know, that on-off switch, statin drug, not statin drug. Right. More like, hey, my LDL is 140. I don't reach criteria for a statin, but maybe I can change my diet to drop it because we know diet can affect those numbers. So I think that's just one example.
Yeah, awesome. So I cut you off there. So one, know your numbers.
Oh, know
Place
your numbers.
To start.
Four things, I would
Four
say.
Four things, okay, cool.
Diet,
yep.
Which we could talk about for forever. And I mean, that's a big one. So you know your numbers. And I recommend, I mean, I look at it through the lens of a cardiologist.
Yeah.
So I look at it through the lens like I want to prevent your heart attack. Mm. And the recommendations that I give are solely based on science and that.
Right.
And that would be to... do your best to reduce animal fat.
Mm-hmm.
Eat a plant-based diet. Reduce your salt intake. You know, they're very simple things. There's no magic to this.
Yeah.
It's just getting patients to do them. So the diet's the big one. exercise. I think exercise, I mean, people hear things like, well, I can't really lose weight with just exercise. And it sort of defeats them from even getting moving on it. But I strongly encourage, at a minimum, to obtain those American Heart Association guidelines, 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous exercise. Pat, I can't tell you how many times I sit across the desk, how many times patient comes in, they don't exercise, you can see that.
Yeah.
And you ask them, do they exercise? And they exercise 150 minutes, yes. And you know that's they're not exercising.
Yeah.
Which is the wonderful thing about wearables. Because you can tell from the
right.
data.
You can actually see if the patient is doing it.
They can keep themselves accountable and you can keep them accountable to, mm-hmm. hey, your heart rate is nowhere near an aerobic zone, right? Maybe 60% of your max predicted heart rate.
Mm.
Like, because we're clocking it on the app. You broke 60% for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, this week.
Yeah. Good start.
Yeah.
Good start, but let's do 7 minutes
exactly.
tomorrow.
So diet number one, exercise. And it's not just aerobic exercise. I always, anything where the data has shown to prolong life, you know, I'm going to recommend with exercise. I think you should work in some high intensity exercise minutes. Another reason I love wearables, we can see where that heart rate is.
Mm.
You certainly don't want to do that for your whole workout, but you should get that heart rate mm-hmm. up. Even for guys who, you know, are doing, or the folks who are lifting a lot of weights, you know, they need those high intensity minutes in there. So exercise is a second big component that just cannot be underestimated, how that can move those metrics. The third, I would say, stress reduction. And I lump a lot in there, and that's I talk about a whole nother podcast. You know, anything you can do to reduce stress is going to be helpful for your heart. That could be mindfulness. That could be reducing alcohol.
Mm.
That's a lot of things. A lot of these things that'll drive that. You need to go find out your heart rate variability.
I do.
It's a lot of those mindfulness type things, because really that heart rate variability is a marker of the parasympathetic and sympathetic balance in your body. And the more relaxed you are, the higher that number is going to be, the more variation of your beat-to-beat heartbeat. And I can see it myself, right? Because I track these things very closely. You know, when I'm stressed out, when I'm working hard, when I'm drinking too much, that number goes down. When I'm on vacation, relaxed, really focusing on, you know, working out and eating healthy, that number goes up.
Mm.
So anything that can, I mean, it's a biochemical reaction that stress induces that's bad for the heart. So stress is a big one. Sleep is like, I feel like, so underestimated. Pat, how many hours of sleep do you get a night over there?
At least 8.
Okay, good.
You know, but I'd like to get 9.
Good.
But yeah.
Good. 8's good.
I aim for 8. Well, I should say I'm in bed, like my alarm's set from 8 hours from when I get in bed. Okay. So might be more like 7.5.
That's yeah. good. You're there. I mean, we know that less than 6 hours is going to increase your risk, you know, for cardiovascular disease. So those would be the big four. I mean, there's a lot of other ones. I mean, obviously smoking's in there.
Yeah.
It's like sometimes you even forget to ask about smoking because you're just sort of assuming.
You just assume people are,
you know,
are past that.
Which I can't believe the data on high schoolers and vaping, which is just as bad as smoking in my mind. But it's really something we should, as physicians, we certainly need to ask about. So obviously smoking would go in there as well. And I feel that... in many instances, the wearables can help. And there's other instances when, for some patients, a wearable is not great. There's certainly problems with wearables. But I think, you know, the increase in wearable use and the increase in the accuracy of these devices are going to make them ubiquitous as we move forward over the next several years.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, we've been obviously talking about heart disease, but what I think is cool is that like all of the suggestions you just gave Like, that's just for prevention of anything, really. It's like, I think a lot of people think, like, you know, there's one thing you do to prevent, like, type 2 diabetes. There's one thing you do to prevent cancers. There's one thing you do to prevent heart disease. There's, you know, and we think there's certain foods for certain things. And maybe to an extent there is, but, like, all of the same lifestyle factors underpin all of those.
Yes.
And it's like, it's the same playbook.
Yes.
For all of them. Right?
Yes. I think is cool. I need to take you along for some of my conversations with some of these stakeholders when they talk about, well, it's just cardiovascular disease.
Right.
And I have to take my hat off to much better cardiologists than myself, but cardiovascular disease encompasses so much.
Mm.
It's under that umbrella is stroke prevention. A lot of what neurologists are and should be doing, diabetes prevention, and all of these things have that exact same underpinning, right? If you eat healthy for your heart, it's the same thing. Like, don't eat processed meat, right? It causes cancer.
Right.
It causes heart disease.
Right.
So it's the same stuff. So I think focusing on the big boy, right, cardiovascular disease, you capture all this other stuff, including cancer risk and all sorts of things.
Absolutely. I love it. So on the, we were talking a little bit before, on the wearable side, do you foresee, like, I was talking, being kind of devil's advocate before this, of like a little bit of the downsides of them in terms of like I see us becoming so dependent on like devices to tell us how we're feeling versus like actually being in touch with your body and listening to the signs of your body and reacting to them. So do you see like any negatives along with all the amazing positives you were just talking about?
There are a list of negatives, right? And I think to your point, the best is to not need them.
Mm.
And so for me, for example, as I mentioned before, sleep's a great one. Some people sort of need to know how they're doing. But you know what? Wearables can be a distraction for others. I don't like the lights, at night. I don't like the feeling on my wrist.
Yeah.
I sleep 8 hours a night like a champ, no problem. So, I don't need wearables. And frankly, I think it's better not to have it. I work with plenty of athletes that know exactly where their pump pulse is. They know where they're at and they don't need the wearables.
Mm.
But I think for the majority of people, they can be helpful. There's issues with them. Are they accurate enough? They're pretty accurate for a lot of the biomarkers now. It gets better every 12 months. Every Apple Watch upgrade, they're getting better. When I build a prototype, the sleep on the Apple, this was 8 months ago.
Yeah.
The sleep, the sleep algorithms on the Apple Watch was using third-party apps and the numbers were not great. It was very inaccurate. And just within 8 months, Apple is, with the most recent upgrade, has their own organic sleep analysis, which is better, right? So that's 8 months.
Yeah, right.
So it's going to get better.
Yeah.
So there's issues. There's issues with the photoplethysmography and the heart rate. We see double counting coming in. The minutes are wrong. But it's as technology moves forward, those things will improve. We also don't know, and we haven't really got into electrograms. So EKGs.
Yep.
So as a cardiac electrophysiologist, I've spent my career looking at 12-lead electrograms. And now, with just touching my watch, the Apple Watch, I have a 1-lead electrogram of very high quality.
Wow.
And, Apple's not the only one. Fitbit Sense has this technology as well. And Garmin will have it eventually. And everyone will have it. And so you can imagine a time in the not-so-distant future when it's not that the user has to sort of press a button. It's just if we're capturing these electrograms almost continuously. And then that'll add to the continued problem of what are we doing with this avalanche of data,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's part of the problem.
Right.
You said you didn't know what an HRV was. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's we have that technology. It's sitting there.
Right.
We have the technology on the wrist. People's Apple Healths are filling up with electrograms that they're taking.
Right.
It's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need the ability for users to connect with experts, with healthcare providers that can help interpret that data. There will be advances in machine learning that'll start looking at these electrograms and distill it down in a way that someone can, you know, a provider can just look at the ones that are very germane to that, that patient. You know, so that the amount of data that's like pouring in into your Apple Health Kit, and that if you just opened up the floodgates would be pouring in to providers is an issue. Mm. So, you know, we're going to need to work with the engineers and figure out a way to distill this data down into a very palatable form. And I think that's where machine learning will play a role. So certainly issues and just the sheer volume of the data. And then we find that this isn't great technology for everyone. And there's early reports of wearable induced anxiety. We've seen it. I see it in my patients sometimes. I encourage patients to send me their data from their wearables just because I want to see it. I love it. I love wearables. But, you know, even the last several years, I've had a couple instances of patients really checking their Apple Watch's EKG to a detriment. You know, I think it can cause anxiety. I think those are relatively rare.
Yeah.
But certainly it's not all roses with wearables.
Right.
There's some issues, but I think that the positives far outweigh the negatives. And I think that as we move forward, just with the advances in technology, some of the things that we're worried about are going to be fixed. And, you know, I certainly want to be along for the ride. Like, we don't know, what does it really mean for a healthy person like you to know that they have atrial fibrillation for 30 seconds?
Mm.
You know, I don't know if we know the answer to that yet. And there's a lot of great physicians, some at MGH doing studies looking at this. Does this really matter? Do we want to know what Pat's what's going on with his heart rate every minute? And it may be that we find out that we don't want to know that.
Yeah.
And whatever that is, you know, the important thing is really to know, just to have knowledge and to do the research.
Right. So the idea on CoreVarix is essentially this platform where it takes all this data, it puts it in a form that is, you know, better able to digest, and then you can also connect with cardiologists and experts that can actually work with you to address some of the things or whatever. Yeah,
that's right. Amazing. So instead of, you know, you see your primary care physician on Friday, he says, Pat, you have high blood pressure. I'm going to put you on this medication called Norvasc. Keep track of your medication. I'll see you next follow-up.
Mm.
Well, how long is that going to be?
Yeah,
like, not going to be next
and
week.
And then you're going to come back and lie and said you did all this stuff.
You know, so instead of just, you know, sort of keeping track of yourself, showing up in 6 months, you know, you can get a call from your virtual cardiologist on Tuesday saying, hey, we were tracking your numbers over the weekend. That dose of 5 milligrams, too much.
Yeah.
Or too little. I can make adjustments.
Very cool.
There. Or, you know, or you can get those nudges that you need for exercise when you're clearly not exercising to where you need to be. Maybe you want a, you know, the technology sometimes is wrong. Sometimes you get Apple Health says inconclusive, possible AFib, and it's not.
Mm.
It's something called artifact. Just having the ability to connect with a virtual on-demand cardiologist that can intervene.
Yeah, that's amazing. Bit of a curveball question I was just thinking of when you were talking. How have you as a doctor, I have an uncle who's a cardiologist, and I've always been like fascinated how he sort of deals with kind of the high stakes nature of everything around dealing with somebody's life or, you know, actually you know, putting someone through, you know, heart surgery and all these things that come with it. How, just from a kind of general health standpoint, how have you been able to kind of like cope with just you being responsible with somebody's life, and sometimes it not going well, sometimes it going well? Like, that's a heavy weight to carry.
I love this curveball question. I'll tell you why. It's interesting. Not an unexpected question. The first 10 years of procedures, screwing wires into patients' hearts, having catheters and burning areas of the heart where, you know, there's a certain risk for these procedures, and right. It's sort of high stakes. Patients can have strokes from the procedures. Patients can die. Procedures. Sometimes these are very sick patients when we're talking about defibrillators and some of these other types of
They're life-saving maneuvers.
They're life-saving maneuvers. And I don't think I really... I thought about it, obviously. I didn't want it to happen.
Yeah.
Certainly didn't take it home with me. And as I got a little older, you know, that really... I mean, just the thought of someone having a bad outcome with a procedure really, really troubled me. Mm. I wouldn't say it's not paralyzing, but, you know, you're worried about nothing was a simple procedure at that point, you know, because they're not. People have very bad outcomes from very straightforward procedures. So my hat is off to just a magnificent group of physicians that I'm working with over at MGH. They're dealing with the sickest patients in Boston, in the region, and they are doing these advanced ablation procedures on really sick patients, life or death. And I think it's amazing to have physicians like that in Boston. For many years, that was something that I enjoyed. I think to the latter half of my career, I didn't enjoy the life or death aspect as much. Would be an honest answer.
Yeah. Yeah, super interesting. You almost have to, like, I would imagine you almost have to, like, for your personal protection, almost, like, disconnect from what you're actually doing a little bit, and, like, disconnect from the fact that you have a human life on your hands. Yep. But at the same time, you do have to connect that. Yes. You know, there's like the two sides of like disconnecting so you can personally like lead a healthy life, but then, you know, actually connecting that holy shit, I'm working on this could kill them or it could save their life.
And I think that's why a lot of people are really drawn to cardiovascular disease. It's a 24/7 operation. You know, here we are sitting at Sunday afternoon here. You know, we'll probably hear a helicopter in a couple of minutes flying over, someone coming in.
Right.
And they're there waiting for them. So there's no stopping that. But yeah, that's an interesting question.
Yeah. I'd love to just kind of, if you would just share where people can follow you. I got one or two, maybe two more, but, before just where people can follow you, follow Corverix.
Yeah, we're an early stage startup. We have Instagram, Corverix. We are now working with an accelerator over at MGH Springboard, and we're establishing partners for a larger pilot study. And we're looking to build a team now. And I'd love to talk to any of your listeners in the life insurance industry. We've become looking at a lot of different customers. There's certainly a lot of synergy. People don't think life insurance is sexy, but there's a lot of synergy with life insurance companies and preventive cardiovascular disease.
There's a lot of incentive for them.
You're completely in line.
Yeah, right.
They want you to live
as long as possible.
You want to live as long. I want you to live long. I'd love to hear any of your listeners who happen to work for life insurance companies or anyone interested in building the team.
Awesome. Love it. Two more for you. The first one is, and I hinted at it kind of before I hit record here, is having worked with patients directly, and like I have a hard time understanding how somebody can choose to continue to live the same way and know that their life is likely going to be shortened for 5, 10, 15, 20, however many years, and choose to continue to live that way and not change when you're talking about, you know, you potentially, you know, seeing your daughter get married and not. Like, I have trouble understanding, like, someone's thought process mm-hmm. around that. And I'd love to get your thoughts on, like, the behavioral change aspect of, like, we, this is, what we have been talking about, I hope, is more and more, like, it's pretty common, I think, obvious things, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, people know they can extend their life by 5, 10, however yep. many years, and they still can't make those changes. Like, can you speak on maybe why you think people just can't take the action to prolong their lives?
It's a great question. I think I should go step out and get my PhD in psychology right now.
Yeah, no, that's what it is, right?
I think part of it is that sometimes they don't know the numbers, and I think that falls on healthcare providers in terms of the lack of education. So I think sometimes it's nice just to really, really drill down on some granular numbers for a patient, like saying right. who maybe your blood pressure is living in the 140s. What do you care? You don't feel that. And maybe just explaining to them, if you can reduce that top number by 12 millimeters of mercury, you can reduce the chance of having a stroke or heart attack by 21%. And really just the fallback, I mean, the honest answer is just education, right?
Lack of education,
Just lack of education. Yeah, they know that, but do they really know? Yeah, they know high blood pressure is bad.
Yeah.
But do they really know that if they change their numbers by just a slight amount, that the huge, you know, benefit that they can find on the other end? Like, do they actually know if you eat fruits and vegetables, like yeah, even like a minimal amount?
Just one meal a day, yeah. right? Well, like, the huge difference that can
you
make,
you
right?
can drop your risk of a heart attack by 30%. Right. But I think just, you know, spending a lot of time on education, it's a frustrating, it's frustrating as a physician 20 years. You're right. You know, getting people to stop smoking, to lose weight, but I think that working with some of these other stakeholders, right, like your insurance company, they care, right. So they want to keep you healthy. You know, just working with patients, providing rewards sometimes, in some cases, you know, there's certainly a psychology to it. And one of the things we're working on is working with policyholders of life insurance companies with rewards programs that can incentivize healthy living and just to work at it at that end, to provide those behavioral nudges. But you're right, it is frustrating when you have to, you know, offer premium reductions to get people to exercise.
Right.
But I think the big answer is education.
Yeah.
I think that's how it's done.
Yeah, and if you were tomorrow in charge of, like, how hospitals are run and healthcare is run in the U.S., would it start with education? Like, is that where you start?
I think it would start with radical changes away from the illness-based fee-for-service model to a preventive, longitudinal, value-based model.
Right. You make money when people get healthy or That's stay
right.
healthy.
That's right. Yeah. You don't make money when patients come in with a heart attack. You make money by keeping them healthy. It's a very hard thing to do. It's working for some other specialties. I don't believe they made much headway in cardiovascular disease. They're doing some great stuff over at MGH with heart failure readmissions, Certainly a lot of value-based programs, but I think we're going to see more and more of that because the cost is astronomical, right? We're talking about life and death. Forget about the cost to the person, right? Which is life, death, but the cost to, you know, the country and to other stakeholders, $1 trillion a year, right? By 2035, $1 trillion. I can't even, you're the entrepreneur. Yeah. That's a lot of money, but we're going to need to do something. So I think that, you know, if I were to run things, it's, we need to make changes. We need to move away from that fee-for-service model to a value-based model. It's a really, healthcare is a challenging ecosystem. So that's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah. I could go all day with you. I love this topic. So before kind of the last one, I'll give you the last word in a minute, but just want to acknowledge you for everything you're doing. And Corverix, I know, will be successful because it's needed. And yeah, just give you a shout out for the work you've done as a doctor and continue to do. And you're obviously quite literally, I try to get on here and maybe influence some lives every day. But you are actually physically working with people like face to face and hand to hand and changing lives. Well, so keep going.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. And I guess I'll just circle back to that last thing that we were talking about earlier is just for the average person to know that for that 30-year-old to know that risk for their first heart attack is preventable. They can prevent it just by taking care of themselves. It's as simple as that.
I love it.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.